Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Dennis McGrath. These days, werewolves are up-and-comers, vampires are played out, and True Blood has just gone nuts. So for a patient but long-suffering genre audience, Lost Girl has come as a breath of fresh air. The series, created by Michelle Lavretta, introduced viewers to Beau, a succubus caught between the world of dark and light fae. With a subtext of female empowerment and slight shades of Buffy, the show vaulted to the top of Showcase's ratings when it premiered in 2010, and has since found a home in the UK, Australia, and the US, as well as a fan base that spans the globe. We sat down with showrunner Emily Andras at the Bell Lightbox in Toronto, a few weeks prior to the show's third season Canadian premiere. Hey, podcast listeners. Before we get to the talk, a couple of things. If you like what you hear, please drop us a line at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. That's writerstalkingtv, all one word, @gmail.com. We'd also love it if you'd logged onto iTunes and left us feedback, as that helps to increase the profile of the show. This podcast may contain language that's unsuitable for young elf ears. And a warning, there's a possibility of mild spoilers ahead. So please, if you don't like that thing, listen at your own risk.
Thank you.
Oh, it's so good to see. You know what? I'm really actually excited that we're able to do this, because I wanted to do this a Lost Girl session for a while.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, honestly. This is such a valuable program. So thanks to Dennis for doing this.
This is amazing, eh?
Yeah. I would have killed for this when I was starting out.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
We had to go to the library and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Internet. What the? Yeah.
So you know what? I guess we live in a sort of a savvier age now, where we're lucky that we live in this age where a little bit of the concept of a showrunner and what they do is actually sort of crossed over, and people kind of know it. But mm-hmm. I think we all have this image of creating television shows. Of, you know, somebody creates a television show and they're the showrunner, and it comes from one vision, and it's sort of, you know, one person's creative toil, and then they you know, have a staff that works with them. But there are other ways to create shows, and other ways that happen a lot in Canada. Mm-hmm. And Lost Girls is one of those shows. So if we do, why don't we start, if you will, by running down a bit of the history of how the show came to be. And there's lots of hands involved in it. So run down some of those people for us and how that sort of came to be.
Sure, I'd love to. Absolutely. Just to be clear, I love Lost Girl. I'm so happy to be the showrunner, but I am a lucky son of a bitch. I absolutely inherited it from some incredibly talented people. It was created by a fabulous writer named Michelle Lavretta, who is one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. She's a genuine broad, and she would be happy to hear me call her that, with probably one of the best imaginations I've ever seen in action. And together with Jay Firestone, who is our producer with Prodigy Pictures, they sort of came up with this concept of basically a female superhero, sort of a revamp of Buffy, but much darker, much sexier. And then first season, Michelle and her big brain teamed up with one of the classiest guys in the business, who I hope you all have heard of, who is Peter Mohan, who is a wonderful guy. Honestly, there is a reason that guy has had a career for, I don't want to age him, as long as he's had. If we all manage to work for 40 years, it should be on the backs of someone like Pete Mohan, who is just a total class act and a wonderful, wonderful producer and showrunner.
We do a Canadian screenwriter meetings. We actually have had the discussion in the last couple of months that, you know, it's getting embarrassing that Peter Mohan is in every issue. But there's a reason why Peter Mohan is in every issue.
He's fabulous. If you ever have a chance to work with him, just do it. And maybe my husband's working with him right now. What? So then we had a very jolly time in first season. It was Michelle, Peter, myself, with Jay's help, and a wonderful writer named Jeremy Boxen. And then I was approached about Michelle and Pete left on completely good terms to do their own thing. Michelle moved to the States, and Pete is in high demand. He is showrunning The Listener right now. And then I got pregnant. Way to go. So when they asked me to run the show, that was my response. No, that was not my response. That was already in play. So the show was handed over in second season to a guy named Jeremy Boxen, who I've spoken of, who's a wonderful writer. alongside someone else called Grant Rosenberg. And together, I'm just going to do some shout-outs with Shelley Scarrow and Duana Taha. That was sort of second season, along with Michelle's involvement. And then I was a creative consultant and wrote a bunch of scripts. And then I was brought on board full tilt in third season for what was largely becoming a huge cult hit in the States and internationally, which was just such a joy, with a fabulous team. Again, I'm just going to do the shout outs because two of those writers are here tonight, even though they listen to me talk about Lost Girl all the time. We have Alex Cerrone, who is incredible, an incredible writer, an incredible person, also came back from having a baby. She's really our procedural, genius. We had Steve Cochran, who was an actor, don't hold that against him, big imagination, big voice, love him to pieces. And Sandra, most complicated last name in the WGC, Fiawaska. We just call her Sandra C, like Cher.
Nice.
So that was our team last year, and it was honestly the dream team.
Great. So we just did we like the worst concert etiquette ever.
I know.
We come on and say, hello, Toronto.
I know.
Let's introduce the band.
I know. I just wanted to say hi because I really wanted to say, although I was a showrunner, as you've said, there were many, many builders in Lost Girl.
But that's a lot of hands.
Yeah.
So what was it you think that – I mean, because obviously, if you meet Michelle Lavretta, mm-hmm. after 5 minutes, you go, oh, you can see a bit of Bo in her, and you can see where that comes from. Mm-hmm. So tell me, I mean, do you have a sense of what was the core that came from Michelle's idea? What got shaped with Peter and stuff? And you obviously, I mean, you were in there, mm-hmm. you were in there before you show ran.
I've been there the whole time.
Yeah.
And I certainly do feel I've had some influence on the show and really got the show and loved the show.
And you clicked with Michelle very much.
We're very close, and I really got what she is trying to do. And essentially, I hope most of you have seen the show, but it is really just unique in that it's about this strong female character who is bisexual. She doesn't really know who she is, and for a long time, she thinks that every one of her lovers turns up dead. So every time she has sex with someone, they die.
Which happens,
which kind of sucks. Yeah. But, you know, through the course of the pilot, she discovers, no, she is, in fact, a mythological creature. She is a succubus. And, in fact, you know, what she thought was a curse is, in fact, her strength, her power, that she can, you know, take energy from people, that she can read people, that she is essentially a superhero. But much in the sense that she is bisexual and sort of a feminist, she is offered a chance to choose sides among this mythological group of creatures called the Fae, the dark side and the light Fae. It's kind of like Harry Potter and the Sorting Hat. And she says, screw that. I'm just going to choose humans. I'm just going to be my own person. I don't want to make choices, just as I don't want to make choices about my sexuality. And that's kind of the theme of the show.
Yeah.
But also in this great genre universe where we're fighting mermaids and werewolves and stuff like that.
Sure.
So, yeah.
There's a lot of people in the audience, I'm sure, if you are writers, you're working on a pilot. And you know, I'm in the middle of it right now, and it's just the hardest thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
But I remember going out at least taking a meeting on Lost Girl.
Yeah.
It was Michelle and Moen in a room. They're down on by where condos are now.
Yeah.
And all they had then, even the pitch there, when you said it before there wasn't anything, you go, okay, it's kind of like Buffy, except she's older.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, that's interesting.
Yep.
And then they pitched the sexuality aspect of it.
Yep.
I'm like, okay, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then you get the idea of, but here's the deal. It's the world is dark fae and light fae, and she's the honest broker between them, and she won't choose sides.
Yep.
And right there, even from that core, you see those three things together, and you're like, okay, I could see the shape of a show there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really strong right off the page. And that is Michelle's gift, I would say, is she writes female characters like no one I've ever met. Like, that character came fully formed. And, you know, when you read the pilot for Lost Girl or you watch Lost Girl, hopefully, you really, really realize how rare that is in a female protagonist, someone who's both strong but vulnerable, who kind of is very sexual but can't hold down a relationship because she keeps killing people. I mean, she really felt like a real girl, a real hero, and very, very fresh. So that's what I think leapt off the page, and I hope that's what sort of resonated with people.
Well, I mean, there's a definite aspect to – I mean, I remember the thing I liked about Alias off the beginning with Jennifer mm-hmm. Garner when she started was, you know, she was this kick-ass super spy and stuff, but – when she got into the shit, she looked scared.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, she looked really scared. Yeah. And you get a bit of that off Bo, too, that there is that vulnerability at the same time as there is the ass-kicking wonderful.
Exactly. Well, this is like this whole new world that she's sort of been thrust into. And, you know, one of the points of pride of the show is, you know, we have these human characters, or at least these characters who thought they were human, being confronted by things that seem to be myths, you know, Bigfoot or leprechauns, except the leprechaun is 6 foot tall. And, you know, we try to do a twist on that stuff. But I do feel that part of our charm is that these characters hopefully react in the way you or I would react if we figured out, okay, there's a mythological race of unicorns and they're all nuns or whatever it was. So we haven't done that episode yet. But
somebody in the audience is like, you spoiled my
unicorn nuns. I just pitched that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's in development.
It's already in development at ABC. It is.
I know. It is probably. Yeah.
Okay. That's, I mean, you know what? I think all writers sort of have we all kind of have this commit point, I think, where, you know, there's that thing where it's like you go out for a job and you're like, okay, I got to get excited about this. Mm-hmm. I got to sign on. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes it's easier and sometimes it's harder and stuff. But what was it about you, about the show initially for you when you first started working on it? You went, this is the thing that I love about this.
Right. See, I'm the opposite. When I heard this show, I was like, this is my crack. I'm home. This is it. Finally, like, I've been very lucky in my career, but I've done a lot of teen stuff and some comedy, but I've always been a genre nerd. So, you know, the truth about a show like this is you really can think big. I mean, it sounds silly and it's still Canadian, but I feel like it's unapologetically fun, first of all, which is very fresh and, you know, God bless everybody working in the world of procedurals. Sometimes fun is something that is actually missing from television, I would say. Believe it or not, you know? We were talking about Justified earlier. Mm-hmm. That's a show that's kind of fun. It kind of makes me chuckle. It kind of makes me grin. And that's what I hope Lost Girl brings to the table. On the other hand, when you're dealing with a show with sort of these big mythological worlds and questions, the truth about genre is you can sort of explore epic themes, you know, because it's such an extreme world and it still has to have its own rules. It's really a forum to kind of both be cinematic and talk about things like the human condition and what is life and what is dark and what is sexuality and what is gender. So that kind of stuff really appealed to me. Just maybe with this little show, we could have some fun. And for a writer, I think those chances are few and far between.
Yeah. You also sort of, you know, procedurals dictate that you have to, you know, it's like the Law and Order formula. It's like guy number one who didn't do it.
Right.
Guy number two that actually did it but doesn't look like he did it. Right. So we got to come back to him in Act Three.
Right. And, you know, and then Martin Short shows up in Act One. You're like, he probably did it.
You're like, come on, Martin Short, come on.
He's probably not going to just do one scene.
But it's one of those. And you know, they're kind of limiting and they are what they are. But one of the things that's amazing about one of the things that's quite good about Lost Girl is that you get a lot of great talent in the show. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's a lot of that has the reason why in every episode you write these really great guest leads. Mm-hmm. You have these really good I mean, is it fun, even the minor characters? Talk about sort of inventing those characters out of whole cloth. Some of your supporting or some of your – I mean, they're rich. There's a richness to this. There's a fun to them. There's a sort of – offbeat, off-kilter thing to every character on the show that's kind of neat.
Yeah, and that's, again, one of the themes of the show. It's sort of like, it sounds very simplistic, but like Bo, I think appearances can be deceiving. So like I said, you know, don't be fooled. We still do procedurals on the show, but we try to twist them. We try to make it unexpected. So I already used this example, but if we bring a leprechaun on the show, the guy's probably going to be 6'4", but he just happens to have descended from a leprechaun family. You know, if we bring a femme fatale on the show, she might be a Wendigo. We really sort of try to play in that realm.
That's a native warrior spirit.
Yes, exactly. Look it up. But the other thing I think that's fun about the supporting characters as well as our main cast is, and one of my favorite things about the show is, much as Bo won't choose, you know, I think people are rarely good or evil, so we really like to play in those shades of gray on the show. So even though someone might have chosen Slytherin, being part of the dark fae, doesn't necessarily mean they're evil. Likewise, someone might have chosen to be light fae, but they might be a hypocrite. You know, we really sort of try to peel back those layers of labels and what people see and what you're supposed to be versus what you really are or the choices you make on how you behave every day. So with whatever character we bring on the show, you know, you may expect one thing when you first meet them, just like our protagonist does, but inevitably people are more than they seem or less than they seem, which is sad.
Yeah. Thematically, I guess imitation, and not to say that these are imitations, because I want to have
do
a career.
Do it.
But imitation are the sincerest form of flattery, all that sort of stuff. But, I mean, you know, Lost Girl comes out. It's obviously a big hit out of the gate.
Yeah.
And now, you know, these are shows that viewers necessarily in Canada won't have heard of yet. But I just got back from Vancouver working on Bitten, which is a werewolf show, female werewolf.
Yep.
You have Continuum, female lead there, Cop from the Future. You have Orphan Black.
Yep.
Clone.
Yep.
Right.
John Fawcett. Yep.
You know?
Get our pilot.
So, I mean, you know, obviously... the networks here have woken up and seen some sort of a pattern here with the female lead, kind of slightly genre-y kind of thing. What is it about that sweet spot that you think appeals to audiences today?
This is loaded, but I'm going to go for it. Okay. I think that women still sometimes are on the fringes of society, are on the fringes of decision-making. So putting a female lead and marrying that with a genre kind of outsider world seems a natural fit to me. You know what I mean? I think there's something really interesting about putting women in a world that is hard to unravel as they try to find their place in it. I just think audiences respond to that. I guess that's my simplistic answer.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's a interesting, and plus also, you know, it's such a fraught sort of thing. I mean, you know, I remember even when I started getting into writing, they said that the audience for drama on television was about 51% female skewed to, you know, 49 male. It's now up to 53 or 54%.
Mm-hmm.
The men are watching cable and football and baseball and hockey.
Yep. All good stuff.
Well, not hockey now.
But, I know.
But and the women are watching TV. So if you're writing television today, you are writing for women.
Most of the time.
And yet, we were talking about this yesterday. Mm-hmm. We had a little pre-interview. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
good stuff got done. Yeah, I know.
But let's get into that now about it. We both have this thing where neither of us can understand. What do you have a theory about this continuing thing that you were telling me that you go out for jobs and you never get to work with all these great female writers because there's always the one or two female writers in the room and the rest are guys and, you know, and yet we have female network executives and we have plenty of talented females. So what is the issue here? We grapple with this at the Guild, too, a lot of the time, too. What do you think still is the holdup with fully matriculating the female talent we have and getting more of a balance in these writing rooms?
Oh, man. Yeah, I don't know. I want to sort of start this by saying, like, if you're a good writer, I literally don't care what you got down there. I just want good writers in my room. But I do notice that there are lots of rooms, particularly in genre, where I see the photo of the room, and it is one female writer and a gang full of dudes. And I just wonder if it's something to do with the nature of being in a television room and really having a voice and being brave enough to use that voice. And on the other hand, I think everybody has to be comfortable with a female writer finding her voice and using her voice in the room. I don't have any answers for this. And again, I want to be really careful. I think there are some incredible female writers in Canada, but it has been rare for me, as you've said, to be in the room with them, to be considered to be in the room with them versus to be in competition with them.
Yeah.
The number of times I've gotten a call from my agent or producer who says to me, you know, they're looking for a female. And I think, to what? Mate with? Like, why? Like, which is cool. I'm into it. What's the pay? No. Yeah. But, you know, it breaks my heart a little bit sometimes versus they're looking for the best writer or the funny person or they only want brunettes. Yeah, I don't know.
Or they're looking for a female writer because they want somebody who can write the chick stuff.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Like I consider myself a fairly progressive person. I have found myself in the situation where you're in a room and it's like literally – it's just you're desperately trying. It's like you're working out a problem with the female character, and it's like, I am not going to look at the female writer. I'm not going to look at the female writer. I'm not going to look at her. And then you're like, and
as long as you look in her eyes, Dennis.
And you look
at
her, and they're always like, really, really.
Yeah. But like that's okay. That's what you bring to the table. Like you know, I don't mind that. And I also want to be careful about this. Just because you presumptively do not have, I'm going to say it on the podcast, a vagina.
Thank you.
Pretty sure that. You know what it's like to have your heart broken or be rejected. And, you know, these things do not necessarily make us good writers. But I do think there's a bit of a struggle there still for female writers. Canada does a lot better than the States. And I feel like this is pretty presumptuous of me to say because I've done very well here and I'm really, really lucky. But it's funny, you know, when I was younger, I noticed it less. And now I feel like my career is advancing and I'm really proud of where I'm at. But I feel like I actually notice it more. The more success I have, the more I feel I'd like to reach out and maybe just say, is this still a situation? Is this still a problem? So maybe.
It is a problem. We've got lots of problems. There's a bigger problem, too, about sort of advancement in the,
yeah.
in the country.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And training
definitely a class.
So hard.
Training's hard, and there's a so much. The thing I say to everybody is it's not hard to get your first job if you've got talent. Yeah. It's hard to get your third job.
Oh, you just nailed it. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's hard to get, you know, and it's hard to, you know, when you hit the glass ceiling in this country, whether you're a guy or whether you're a dude or a woman, you hit it hard.
Oh,
you
know? It's really hard. I wish we did have more. Yeah, those middle positions are the hardest. It's hardest to be the second and the third, and it's hard to be a really solid second and third. And I do feel like, you know, it's the same old problem, and I don't want to just bitch about. I want to talk about what's great about this country and how we're fixing things. But there's just not enough work. There's just not enough shows for you to be a third or a second on more than one show. But I think we're going to fix it. I think it's getting better.
There's also a simple math thing for writers, too, in the sense that if you're an actor, you can book 6-7 shows during the course of a year. If you're a director, you know, you go in, you work prep, and you do your episode, and you go. And you can direct 3 or 4 things a year. If you're a writer, you're either developing or you're staffing. If you're staffing, you're tied to one show for 6 months.
Yep.
If you're developing, you're because of the economics of it, you're developing 2 or 3 things at once and going, hey, you know, talking and shining different producers and different networks on, going, yeah, baby, you're my only one. You're the only one I'm working on. And then suddenly something goes, and it's never the one you think is going to go, and you got to drop everything and go work. So it's very stressful.
It is very stressful.
Yes. Well,
welcome to the big time, Dennis. Welcome to the big leagues.
I know. This is why I take Advil.
Yeah,
anyway,
exactly.
All right. So meanwhile, back at the reason why we're here, Lost Girl.
Yeah.
So can you do us a favor and run down a little bit? What is your work week like? Describe to us what is your, you know, you come in on a Monday.
Right.
When you're in, say you're in production.
Right.
Tell us about what do you do during the course of a week?
Right. So like many jobs, I would say the difference between being good at your job and being a manager is exponential. So the truth about being a showrunner that is really hard for a lot of writers is just because you're good at writing doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be good at managing people. Mm-hmm. And like 90% of my job all day long is just managing people. People I really like, people I like less. It's ego management. It's decision making. So it's meetings. Like, to be completely frank, it's meetings. So my day is packed full of meetings. And what people want from me, which I think is important as a showrunner, and what I deal with every week, which one deals with every week as a showrunner, is I need to make decisions. The buck has to stop somewhere, and it's important to have a vision. The beauty of television, which many of these podcasts have talked about, it is truly collaborative. And I literally could not make this show on my own. The producer hires, together we hire the best people to support me. And when they make good decisions, they make me and the producer look like a freaking genius. But my job is basically just keeping the show going. So my job is meetings all day long, making decisions, making the final decisions. And also, I think, just making sure people get heard. I think that is like the biggest tip I can give for all you aspiring showrunners is you have to trust that people are good at their job and want to do good work, and they want to be respected for what they do. Mm-hmm. So if there's ever an opportunity for you to thank them for the job they do, tell them they do a good job, or defer to them because they are the expert at what they do, they will come back and help you out down the line tenfold. And that day where you have to break a chair over their head because it wasn't what you asked for or the decision got lost in the mail, I feel like that goes a lot further because mm-hmm. you have been supportive. All that being said, my number one priority as the showrunner is just getting the story right, getting those scripts perfect. That is all the other meetings could fall aside. It would all get done. But my number one priority is the writing room. So week to week, you know, I'm in the writing room. I'm guiding the breaking of an episode wherever we are at. And then I'm going to meetings. I'm not a big one for being on set, just personally, because I have a family and I have a life, and I think the writing is my priority. You will meet other showrunners who love to be on set, who want to be on set 24 hours a day. I like to go for the important stuff, but again, that is something that I feel should be getting done by people I assign to be there, to be mm-hmm. completely honest. So that's just me personally. And rewriting is a big deal. Like rewriting and looking at scripts, just guiding that script, making sure it's as close to perfect as I can get it when it goes out the door, that's the majority of my job.
How much rewriting is there on the show?
Very little, because we have incredibly strong writers, some of whom I called out today. I am a big believer in getting it right by the time it goes to outline. I really, really think if you can get it as close as possible to a story you would want to write. That, for me, is how I know the episode is good. When I look at all the cards on the board and I'm like, you asshole, I want to write that episode.
Right.
And then I can pass it over to a writer, or I know they're going to get it. As you know, there's always exceptions to the rule. There's always like the network hates it, or the producer is like, this isn't what we wanted, or frankly, it comes back and it's not there. But to be honest, I really, really trust my team, and I feel like we do so much front-end work with breaking the arc, breaking the season, breaking the outlines, that I don't feel there's a lot of rewriting. There's polishing, there's jokes. Some of us write better characters than others, so we do pass it around. And I'm also not opposed to that. I think everybody gets their script passed around. There's all the glory in the world for everybody, but I expect everybody to help with every script.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's back it up a little bit. You're the beginning of a season.
Yep.
You sit down there. Walk us through a little bit about when you sit down, those first meetings, you know, as you're sitting there staring at the awful, evil, blank board with nothing on it.
Right.
How do you go about, what's the process of coming up with the arc for a season? And then beyond that, when you sit down to breaking an episode, do you have a trick or a method for how you approach the breaking of an individual episode?
Oh, man. Well, you know, our show is Lost Girl. It is about a girl, Bo. So really, it is initially always about Bo's journey. What mm-hmm. is Bo's journey this season? What is she going to learn? Where do we need her to be? What are the stakes for Bo? So I like to break it character by character most of the time. We are a mythologically based show. We need big stakes. So generally, we need to know what the big threat, what the big journey is going to be for our characters, both separately, individually, and as a whole. Are they going to be, you know, Buffy used to call it the big bad. Right. Who is the big bad this season? What is the big deal? What are we working toward on a mythological level? But another huge part of our show, actually, and part of the reason we have such a huge fan base, is our relationships. So certainly that soap opera type, you know, I'm reluctant to use that term, but it's huge. The love triangle, who Bo is romantically involved, who's getting involved with whom, that needs to be at the forefront of breaking the arc. As far as an episodic breaking, you know, I probably shouldn't have dissed the procedural, because we still have a case every week,
right.
You know, and now we are entering, you know, we're about to start season 3 in January, fingers crossed for a season 4. One of the, you know, benefits and beauties of having fans kind of buy into this world and something I enjoy is I do feel that Lost Girl has become less episodic and more serialized, which is where everyone hopes to get. If people buy into the world and the characters, you're gravy, right? You can really sort of move away from that procedural model. But we still need to know the A story. Is it kind of like a case of the week? What are we doing? What are we battling? And I would say that's about 70% of the episode. I'd say 20% is the mythology or the relationships. You know, where are we at with the romances, with the friendships? Who doesn't like whom? And then I should correct myself. 20% is the relationship. And then I'd say about 10% is just the mythology. You know what I mean? Is where are we moving along the arc? Are we getting closer to battling the big evil? What's happening? Who's betraying whom? And as you get closer to the end of the season, you know, your A story, your case of the week shrinks to about 50%, and the mythology kind of rears its head, I would say.
Do you build towards do you have that thing where – I'm going to ask this question. I remember – David Chase has got this thing, and everybody's asked me, where is this article? You always talk about Dennis, and I never remember where it is. But David Chase talked about the thing where it's like you blow your brains out in the first four episodes. Episode five is a change of pace.
Yep.
Episode six and seven, you save money. Yep. Episode eight and nine, you do a bottle episode or whatever it might be. 9, 10, 11, you blow your brains out again. 12, it's the end. And 13 is the denouement and the setup to next season.
Yes, what David Chase said.
Is that how you do it?
No, 100%. Like, you know what the hardest episode is? Number two. It's always the fucking killer.
Now do it
horrible.
Again.
Yeah. But like with less money, and also it has to be kind of what I'm going to watch every week. Like, God bless episode two. It's just so hard, right? And every network show I watched this year, I was like, poor Last Resort. I'm like,
I know.
Oh,
it's like,
they're not going to die because they can't. It's episode two. There's definitely that model. Like episode one is like, we went way over budget. We hired the crazy French director and my God, but it looks so good, but it's kind of crazy. And the actors are, you know, still getting into their groove. Episode two is usually a case for us, a strong case. Yeah. Three and four is kind of like, okay, the mythology rears its head. Like, what is the battle going to be? But, you know, I don't put too much stock into hard and fast rules like that. And again, because we have the luxury of three seasons now under our belt, I'm a big one for let's break all the rules. You know, we can do some shortcuts now with the audience because I feel like they are along for the ride.
So you've earned that.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. Yeah.
What are you what's your pattern, so to speak, about how many days in, how many days out, how much do you shoot on sets? You
know? So we are 7 days. Keep in mind, Boardwalk Empire, 17 days. It breaks my heart every time.
Right.
So we are 7 days. We tend to be about 3 days out, 4 days in, I would say. We have an occasional six-day episode, an occasional killer bottle, and sometimes we stretch to 8 days. But we try to make good use of our sets. We have beautiful sets. They're absolutely beautiful. We have an amazing DOP. So we're lucky that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you're sitting down, we're jumping around now, but we're just going crazy.
I'm sitting down right now.
When we,
I'm ready.
When we, when you sit down to break the episode, what is a writer, somebody you've got on staff, when they come in with a pitch, what is that? What do you get them to come in with originally when you start spinning the story up?
Right. So with Lost Girl, one of the huge proponents of our show is that basically Bo is encountering creatures that are mythological in nature, but oh my God, they exist, they're real. So, and we try to sort of take from mythology around the world. So generally, my writers will come in with a cool creature from Sumatra, and it's like a twist on this, and then they will have an A story that is sort of based around that creature. That's the most base model of what an A story is. Again, if it's an episode that's more mythologically based or more serialized, they may come in with a story that's thematically about where Bo is at emotionally, and then how are we going to visualize that? Okay, we're going to bring in this creature who, like, can't feel love, or that's the most basic, horrible, horrible pitch I just did. But do you know what I mean? Yeah. Don't use that. Or maybe.
Not this,
or
not
maybe.
This. But,
I don't know.
But
not
maybe this,
but maybe that. So again, you know, I generally find that before the writers even come in with a pitch, they know where they're at in the season. So if it's episode two, they're like, I got to have a great case. If it's episode nine, it's the mid-season kind of climax. They need to deal with all the characters. They need to get the characters to where they all need to be for the back half. But we do a lot of research, which is super, super boring. But, you know, it's amazing how much you can base a really great episode on a really great monster of the week, which sounds crazy, but it's true. Or the other thing we do a lot on Lost Girl is sort of take your expectations of, like, noir or a horror movie. We sort of do homage to, like, tropes that are familiar, but then you throw in, like I said, Bigfoot or a mermaid, and how does that sort of play out? So we try to twist it. You know, I do feel this show has a fairly modern sensibility, and the audience is fairly young. So we can play with those kind of expectations of how the episode's going to play out and how the trope would normally go, and turn it on its head. So that's another thing. The writers will come in and say, okay, this is a femme fatale story, but here's the way it's going to play out that's different. We did an episode... Oh, I'm totally going to do a spoiler. I can't do it.
I already did a spoiler alert. I got you covered. Do the mild spoiler.
It's mild spoiler. Okay, so we have a horror movie episode that was written by someone in the audience, Sandra, where, you know, it's a horror movie. The babysitter is at home. The phone rings. Oh, my God. The call's coming from inside the house. And the babysitter, you know, brings the case to our girls. But, of course, the babysitter, without knowing it, maybe turns out to be not what she even thinks she is.
Right.
So it's sort of that kind of wah wah. That's the simplest version. Wah wah. That's the technical writing term.
Do you actually do wah wah?
We do wah wah. Just a series of foghorns on the table. So when people are pitching, I'm like, yeah, just a series of cartoon noises.
That's
yeah.
Good. That's great. Yeah. Good. Good. Yeah. You also have the benefit of pretty terrific cast in the sense
amazing.
That it's amazing. Like, you know, I remember the first time, the first episode even seeing, I don't even know how to say her name. You know who I'm talking about.
Anna Silk.
Now, well, Anna Silk is really quite...
Ksenia Solo?
Yes, Ksenia Solo. There you
amazing.
Go.
Amazing.
But, I mean, crazy. Like, you
crazy
know,
good.
Like,
so
crazy
good.
And really interesting. And so, I mean...
Like, scary.
Do you just... How do you approach... Talk a bit about sort of what you... Do you ever say to yourself, well, what are we going to throw at this character?
Yeah.
How much do you... There's that great thing. You're in season three now. You get that great... example that some Canadian shows don't ever get to, which is now you know your actors well enough that you can write for the actors. Talk about how that's changed the writing a little bit.
This is boring fangirling, but we truly, truly have an incredible cast. They are so strong, and it is amazing when you put them together, the chemistry they have. That is magic in a bottle, and that you can't buy. That is cast of friends territory we're going to, right? Mm-hmm. Like, literally. Like, you put them all together, and it's magic. I do think it's important to learn your actor's strengths and weaknesses. You know, Anna Silk is like the loveliest person you'll ever meet in your life. But the truth is, and she would say this herself, she's not like the toughest person you would ever meet in your life. You know, she's not sort of Sigourney Weaver from Alien. She's amazing and she's athletic, but she's just so vulnerable on screen. So when we figured out that Bo should be that vulnerable, should use Anna's kind of fragility at the same time she's so tough, that's when I feel like you've really captured something that is unique and good for them to do. It's funny to talk about Ksenia Solo because she is largely a dramatic actress, but she serves as the comic relief on our show, and her timing is like impeccable.
Amazing
it's talk. Incredible. She's such a find, and she's going to go far. So we do write to our characters' strengths and weaknesses 100%. But, you know, the other truth with season three, and we've done this before, is they are all so – they have such good range that I'm kind of a jerk. Sometimes I like to challenge them. Like, we did the body swapping episode where they all had to play each other. I, like, had just had the baby 4 weeks ahead of time. I wrote it. It was crazy. That's what I blame it on. But, like, they were amazing. You know what I mean? I was kind of like, here you go, jerks. I'm at home in my yoga pants. I don't know. But, like, it was amazing, you know? Like, I do think it's kind of important.
Special effects. This episode, you're the special effect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was kind of amazing. And when you see them stretched like that, it just makes you want to, you know, give them those opportunities. And people get hungry after 3 years, you know, to be honest, like, the show is a success. And everybody starts to become aware that the show is a success and they want to do well and want to try new things. On the other hand, there's lots of times where you, God bless them, you just know people's limitations, even if they don't know it themselves, or frankly, what you need the character to do. You know what I mean? You have to serve the show as a whole. You can't just serve the actors, obviously, you know? And I really trust my actors. We're on fairly good terms. But I've had many an occasion where I've had to speak to an actor and say, this is what's best for the show. I know you don't want your character to be perceived as unlikable or what have you, but it is ultimately a drama. It is ultimately, you need to serve the show and you have to trust me. And that's something you earn. You know, that's not something you just buy. Yeah.
What do you think, what are the biggest challenges to telling stories in your universe? What's the hardest thing?
Money, money, money.
Yeah, it's all money.
It's so boring, right? It's so boring, but so delicious and green. honestly, like, I'm sorry, but it's hard, right? Like, you write an episode with a lava monster, and you're like, is it going to be a puppet? It's going to be a puppet. It's going to be a puppet on fire. An awesome puppet.
But, we can't afford the puppet.
We can't afford the puppet.
We can't get the puppet.
We got Janie Swift.
It's actually, we went to CBC. It's actually Finnegan.
Yeah, it's actually Finnegan. Yeah. Oh, you can't burn Finnegan. Are you kidding me? We would hate me. I'm sorry. It's so boring, everybody. I wish I had a better answer. But honestly, particularly in genre, like special effects, right? It's like, are you going to George Lucas it or are you going to George Lucas it, Phantom Menace it?
But I also...
It is hard.
Don't you also find that I think we're at this point now with digital effects and stuff that the digital effects guys and the physical effects
guys...
Who
are amazing on our show. I actually have to say that. I'm sorry. They're so good. Yeah.
But they are kind of like IT guys now, right?
They are.
Like in terms of the attitude they give you.
Yeah, and no matter what, I got it. It's all right.
And you're constantly getting that thing where the thing that you think is going to be really hard, they're like, oh, no, that's no problem. And the thing that you think, you know, okay, I wrote this to be easy on you, and they just give you the look.
It's like, can we change your hair? God, no. Like, that's the thing. And it's like, 50 dragons? I got it. No problem. But, you know, I will tell you something. Here's my encouraging December, not Scrooge answer. I swear to God, it has made me a better writer.
Yep.
Writing in Canada, having to do those problem solving. Like, be like, we can't do that. But what can we do that is equally as awesome or emotional or satisfying in a way that isn't landing 747 on a highway, which 24 did once, and I just about cried. Yeah. I was like, they just landed a plane on a highway. Like, honestly, that is my true answer. You can go anywhere if you've worked in Canadian genre, because I think it really does force you to use the resources you have and force you to not be lazy. Like, that's my honest answer.
It's true. I mean, you know, what is, you know, any problem can be solved by opening your wallet and throwing down 20s, you know?
Like, or a dragon. Like I said, just put a dragon in the sea. Yeah.
I wish I had a dragon.
I know, me too. That's my biggest challenge, I would say.
What do you think the biggest thing, this is more of a student, more of a fan question for you, but let's see how you do with this. What do you think, what's the biggest thing about Lost Girl, the writing or the creation of Lost Girl, that you think that fans would never figure out by watching the show?
I don't know, what would fans never figure out? Just how collaborative the process is, I would say. Like, really, how many people, that's such a boring answer, but how many people it takes to build every episode. Like, Lost Girl is a really new phenomenon for me personally, because it does have an enormous fan base. And it's kind of this collision, I don't know if you're going to talk about this later, of these two sort of marginalized fan bases, which is genre people, who are like no longer marginalized. I don't know if you've heard of a movie called The Avengers, but you guys are pretty much mainstream. But also the LGBT community, right?
Yeah.
Who have really adopted this show as their own. It is so unusual to have a protagonist on television who is bisexual and frankly may or may not be entering into a monogamous real life relationship with another woman. You know, like this, and we don't judge, we don't label it. So these two communities have just embraced our show, but they are vocal. You know what I mean? They want what they want. So this is the first show, ego check, that like I get hate mail, you know?
Yeah.
People think I do not like the lesbians. I love the lesbians. No, but do you know what I mean? Like, I get a lot of, we get a lot of feedback from the fans. And I just think, I think if they knew how much thought we put into the season as a whole, that we want to take them on a ride, on a journey, I don't know. Maybe they'd be surprised, or maybe they wouldn't. I don't know.
It's so strange that aspect of it now. It's like, you know, I think Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller said, you know, thousands of years ago, sitting around the campfire, you know, Og could have been telling the story of the great wars, and right. and then turned to you and said, "Well, what do you think happens next?"
Yeah,
but that's not the gig, no. you know. Like, and the number of times that you've been surprised by a character taking you. I mean, I guess it all boils down to that whole thing of that. In many ways, our job is to give you something that is emotionally satisfying. It yeah. gives you kind of what you wanted, mm-hmm. but not in the way that you expected.
Exactly.
To get it.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
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 It's fun. Fun. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's shift gears before we watch the episode here
sure.
a little bit. Let's fill in a bit of your history a little bit. Because I remember the last time we sort of talked, I think that we met and we talked about Lost Girl, and I think it was at the point where you're getting ready to go off and have – somehow you managed to engineer it so that you were show running a show and having a baby and then having your baby and coming back to the show.
I did.
So my question is, are you crazy and how did that happen?
I am crazy. I can't tell you how it happened if you don't know by now. That's your own problem.
I've been shown diagrams, but
yeah, exactly.
it's frankly
it
magical just
night.
Grosses me out a little bit.
Twice. Yeah, I have two beautiful children, and I did a crazy thing, which is both times I was up for running a show, I went and got pregnant. I was also supposed to run – I had run a show called Instant Star mm-hmm. on CTV, and then I got pregnant. I'm going to be honest. I'm a very good manager, but my house looks like an episode of Hoarders. It is horrible. It's crazy. Look, I think the whole work-life balance thing, you've got to make your own choices, right?
Yeah.
I do make my own choices. I mean, I really, really think it's important for writers to have a life outside of writing, and that doesn't necessarily mean children or an episode of Hoarders.
Right.
But I just think you need to go home at 6 p.m., and when you walk in the door, you should feel there's something else you can put your time towards, if only for a couple of hours, so you don't kill yourself. Like, that mm-hmm. sounds horrible, but when you live in your mind like we do, and when you can always do work, you can always pick up a computer, they can always find you, you need something else. And also, what are you writing about if you do not have interests and life and experience, love, and all that stuff? You know, I just think it's important to have a well-rounded life. As far as balance, it was crazy. Look, I made my own choices too. I absolutely love my kids because they're the best kids in the world. Nobody's ever said that before, but it's true about my kids. But here's what was right for me. My husband, who's in the audience, is also a writer, which mm-hmm. is also crazy. Don't do that. Marry a civilian.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that in a second.
Okay,
but
good.
Keep going.
Let's make him stand up. No, that's not. So I personally, as a woman, really, really like using my brain. I absolutely love, love, love my kids, but I can only watch so many episodes of Dora
right.
During the day. I can't do crafts. So for me, the best decision was coming back before my year of maternity was up. And I have another friend who was a single mother and raised her kids and is a writer in Canada who said to me, don't you actually put your money where your mouth is. If you like going to work and you think that makes you well-rounded, don't you actually want to show your daughter that she can have it all? I think I'm a better mother because I go to work and I work mm-hmm. hard and I love being with adults and I love using my brain. And then when I come home and I see my kids, it is all about my kids. But I'll tell you, I have had the luxury, because of where I am in my career, of also saying, you know what, I'm going home. I'm going home at 6:30, or I'm going home at 7, or can this wait till tomorrow? You know, show running is a full-time gig. Don't get me wrong. Like, I have homework every night. I get up early in the morning. I do stuff. My husband's like, you don't get up early in the morning. There's no right message here. You know what I mean? You have to do what's best for you. My husband and I, you know, more specifically, he has been a showrunner in the past. We try not to have showrunning gigs at the same time.
Right.
You know, that's one thing we do. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with sort of picking and choosing. And oh my God, it's such a luxury to be at that point in my career mm-hmm. where I can sort of say no sometimes. There's a lot of power in the no. And when you first, as a writer, get to the point where you can say no to something, there's so much freedom in that,
yeah.
you know?
It really yeah. is. I mean, that's, in many ways, everybody goes, oh, getting an agent. That's a bit.
Yeah.
The biggest rite of passage,
yeah.
I think, when you're a professional screenwriter is is going, no, I don't want to work on that. No.
And
no.
I'm a people pleaser. So my instinct is to say yes. But it's unusual too in Canada, I think, sometimes to say no. And that's when you know you've made it. I think when you can turn down a gig and feel like this is the best decision for me right now and my family, if that's where you're
now,
at.
Now, a second ago, you said something very controversial. And there is a real split. And I, you know, this is an ongoing argument. There's lots of people that say out there that, you know, screenwriters only slightly less difficult to be in relationships with than actors. You know, we're different kind of crazy. I think it's more socialized crazy. But still, we're a bag of toys, you know, and we're inside our own heads.
But we're behind the scenes, so we're like.
So now, you just said, Marius, you know, have a relationship with a civilian.
Yeah.
Is that honestly what you believe?
Hi, Brendan. There are so many days, honestly, where one of us says to the other, why couldn't you have been a dentist? I mean, honestly. Now, the funny thing about us is we met before we both sort of became screenwriters. So there you go. Look, I'm the crazy one. I'm just going to come out and say that. But I think only one of you can be crazy at a time.
Yep.
That's the rule in our house. It's always me. But that is, and you know, I have to give credit to my husband. We have a lot of rules about bringing work home. We used to work at the same place. He used to work on Degrassi and I was on Instant Star, which is Epitome. So we would drive home together. So Brendan had a rule that we could talk about work and all the people we worked with on the ride home, but then it was over when we walked in the door. I do think you have to set those boundaries.
That's a great rule.
It doesn't mean I didn't turn over at midnight and was like, just kidding, I have to pitch about someone else. But look, on the other hand, the hours are so crazy and you're so in your head that it is such a blessing having someone who understands that. You know what I mean? Who understands that black dog of darkness at 4 a.m. when you're like, I'm going to vomit. This is horrible. I can't write this. I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way, just to say that. Because we're crazy. You need someone to understand the crazy. But it's hard. You got to balance it, I think. We don't work together. That's another thing. We don't write together, which I think helps us. And we don't generally read each other's stuff that often. We just try to.
Okay.
I know.
That's interesting.
Who's the boss? Who's the boss when you're working together, man? It's me. Crazy boss. No, I don't. That's just for us, though. I know lots of writing couples who do work together and work together very well.
Yeah.
James and Shelley represent. But, you know, that's what works for us. So.
Okay. What did you pick up? First of all, way back at the beginning, how did you get into writing?
Right.
And talk a little bit about your experience at Epitome and what did you learn from that shop? That's pretty much the closest thing we have to a sort of, you know, long-running mini studio in Canada.
Oh,
So tell us what you picked up with there.
Oh, my God. Epitome, Degrassi, season 13, right? 30 years.
Right.
A lot of teen pregnancy.
Right.
I will say this to you, and there's lots of Epitome people in the audience. Honestly, that is, you know, aside from the CFC, personally, in my opinion, the best place to learn how to write in Canada. They are so polished and so professional, and they churn out so much material. But they're incredibly supportive of young writers. They need young talent. They need people who are fresh and bring that kind of enthusiasm to the table. I really earned my story-breaking chops at Epitome. I think they do not let you get away with anything. They really know pace. They know story. They know character. It was a fabulous place to learn, to be completely honest. And I met so many incredible writers have come out of there. I mean, lots of people have worked there. It's been there for a long time. But so as far as getting started, I'll just talk a little bit about that. I went to Ryerson to Radio and Television Arts, and then I had a project where I had to write a spec script. I wrote one for friends, and I had to get someone in the business to adjudicate it. So I panicked, last minute, typical, sent a bunch of emails to writers in the WGC, and that's the first time I figured out writers are incredibly generous, because I would be hesitant to do this now, so awful. No, I wouldn't, but maybe a little bit, depending on where I am. But a lot of people read my script, and I got a variety of notes from it. You know, I got conflicting notes, and that really kind of helped break down the wall of fear, you know, like all these people are real writers and I'm not a real writer. But when I got the notes, I saw how varied the opinions were. Mm-hmm. One thing everyone agreed upon was like, you don't know anything about structure. And one writer, well, just fine. You have to learn that. And one writer in particular, his name is John May, who's still very active and does a lot of kids stuff, very generously sort of said to me, okay, you've got a voice, work on your stuff all summer, and I'll give you a shot on my show, which was a show on CBC called Our Hero. So I got to write an episode of that, which was incredible. But in the meantime, after I wrote Our Hero, I was going back and forth at production jobs. Like, I was coordinating at the W Network. I was, like, working the award shows at CBC. You know, Brendan famously drove the van with all the Gemini Awards. I was like, we can take these all. We can take these all. We can run away. So you just want to kind of keep a foot in the door, which is what I did. And, you know, it's relationship-based. So I met a lot of people just doing that kind of stuff. And that's how I got involved with Epitome. They had this new show called Instant Star. I had met a bunch of the writers who were kind of dickering with it. And they said, do you want to come on and do a pass of the Bible? And I said, sure. Did a pass in the Bible. They really liked my work and then hired me on staff as the junior coordinator. And then I kind of rose through the ranks. So that's how I started.
That's great. Good. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to drop us a line, please write us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. We'd also love it if you logged onto iTunes and left us some positive feedback because, you know, that helps increase the profile of the show. This is brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada, thanks to Tiff Bell Lightbox. Our technical producer is Philip Vukovic, and I'm Dennis McGrath. Thanks for listening.